This episode of CPR's Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the College of Law and the College of Music and Media at Loyola University, New Orleans. If you're a parent, you know the value of a backyard play date or an afternoon outing in the park. Fresh air, a space to run wild and free, open terrain with nothing to knock over or to stain. Your kids, they get to explore. They make friends. Maybe you get some respite too. Sharing moments like these with my sons gave me some of the best memories of parenthood. My kids are grown up, but they still ask me for a quarter if they can correctly identify a species of tree on a walking trail. But you know, unfortunately, outdoor learning and fun isn't a reality for a lot of families. These days, in neighborhoods around the country, pollution fogs the air, heat penetrates spaces and surfaces, and an alchemy of both of those things, polluted air and heat, result in terrible contamination. In some parts of the country, sending the kids outside can be dangerous, deadly even. Because of the impacts of the climate crisis, children are getting sicker, heavier, and less mobile. They may be forced to stay inside, avoid exercise, eat poor quality foods. In more catastrophic situations, they're losing their childhoods to destructive natural disasters. Either way, the physical and mental consequences of these circumstances have long-term effects on their futures and on the future of our planet. Of course, some kids don't even believe they have a future.
If you're not concerned about this, you're not paying attention. And the reason that people are feeling so much hopelessness is not because of fear-mongering, it's because of a lack of action.
You can see that we're poisoning our children and making it that much more difficult for them to have viable choices in terms of having a productive life.
There's two little league fields that have been contaminated with lead, arsenic, and manganese. Parents were super concerned because they said their children had been playing on that little league field for the past 30 years. You know, some parents have been coming out of the woodwork telling us their children have died from cancer and they had played on that field.
There has been a disconnect between some of the ways that we've been moving forward in our society just with respect to our relationship with land. You know, raising children to have that consciousness around having reverence for the resources that we directly depend on. They enjoy it, and I think, you know, moving forward in their lives will help them make informed and good decisions.
Kids, given a chance, can recover and be part of the solution. Our society depends on it. It's not just a nice thing to do.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, season four, we're examining the impact of climate disruption across the globe and how it's affecting you. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. On today's episode, our children. Growing up in a world already devastated by climate disruption, how do young people look towards and build for a better future? We discuss health consequences, policy initiatives, the power of innovative parenting, and the need for positive action. Childhood is supposed to be a time for magic, real or imagined. Days spent building sandcastles, digging tunnels in the dirt, hoping to reach the other side of the world. Afternoons running around in fields of gold, playing pirates, superheroes, spending nights wishing on stars, wondering about the secrets in the enchanted woods. It can be really great to be a kid, right? That is, assuming you don't have to worry that running around in the backyard or the school playground is going to get you sick. For some children, playing outside can lead to an asthma attack brought on by allergies and air pollution, or heat stress caused by humidity and rising temperatures. We're all dealing with it, but kids, they're more susceptible. Their developing bodies easily fall victim to the forces of climate change. Their hearts beat faster, their breathing rates increase, and they absorb more air pollution. Research shows that air pollution shortens the life expectancy of children by almost 2 years on average. Exposure is linked to heart problems, cancer, premature death, and, as we've already discussed, asthma. Now factor in the obesity epidemic facing American youth, and the situation escalates. Almost 20 years ago, the World Health Organization estimated that climate disruption contributed to more than 150,000 deaths worldwide, and 5.5 million people saw their life expectancies reduced. These numbers alone are alarming, but when you find out that 88% of the burden occurred in children under the age of 5, it's all the more unsettling. And that was 20 years ago. Now, other research shows heat-related illnesses are the leading cause of death and disability in young athletes. Young men, they make up a third of all heat-related emergency room visits in the United States. And football players specifically are 11 times more likely to suffer exertional heat illnesses. These are just a few of the physical calamities attributable to the climate crisis. And there are mental health blows as well. A 2019 study found that short-term exposure to high ambient air pollution corresponded with a rise in visits to children's psychiatric emergency departments for adjustment disorder, suicidal thoughts, and schizophrenia. No matter how you look at it, kids are hit from every angle. Leslie Fields, Senior Director of Environmental Justice and Healthy Communities at the Sierra Club, breaks it down further, noting the specific harms that children face in their daily rituals.
Kids are not little adults. They are breathing faster, their respiratory systems are developing, their brains are developing, they are closer to the ground, they're out there playing, they're rolling around in the dirt. They are absorbing not just the particles from the air, but it's coming in through their bodies. You know, little kids put everything in their mouths, right? You know this. The cognitive development for children being exposed to trauma from climate change and then also from contamination from climate change.
In their yard, at school, on the playground, even just getting around, children face increased exposure to a variety of environmental pollutants that are amplified by the climate crisis. And as they get older, these harms get worse. Let's start with pollution. Okay, we know it's bad. We see smog staining the skyline in lots of cities. But did you know that climate change negatively affects indoor air quality too? Indoor air pollution is responsible for the deaths of an estimated 1.6 million people every year, and more than half of those deaths occur among children under the age of 5. That same dirty air swirling around the atmosphere can eventually make its way inside a house, through door jams and windowsills. Dust, soot, and other particles get trapped in carpeting and building surfaces. On top of that, a lot of things in your house, like presswood cabinetry and synthetic carpet, they emit dangerous chemicals, a process that scientists call off-gassing. Anyway, exposure to pollution like this has a range of health consequences. Research published in the New England Journal of Medicine found that the children who grew up when the air was better quality had more functioning lung tissue. Further, because of their smaller lung capacity, children are unusually vulnerable to ozone conditions, that's smog, and such exposure has been associated with increases in asthma. One study found that increases in ground-level ozone attributable to climate breakdown would lead to an increase of childhood asthma from 5% to 10% in New York City this year. We met Gina Ramirez in our last episode. She's an environmental advocate, also a third-generation Mexican-American living in Chicago, and a mother, too. Pollution is so bad in her neighborhood, they're visited by something known as the asthma van.
It's like a free health clinic in a van because a lot of people in my neighborhood don't really have insurance. So it's a way for children to get tested while they're in school and get their medication or to get their inhalers on a monthly basis and just to sort of keep track of how they're doing, managing their asthma. It's only really on the south and west sides of Chicago where there's a heavy concentration of industry that asthma vans come. We collect toenail samples of those children because heavy metals will stay in your fingernails and your toenails, and you could test for them. And so we're actually taking toenail clippings from the children who have asthma in the neighborhood and testing for levels of manganese. Manganese exposure, if it's inhaled, can lower your IQ, cause developmental disability.
Asthma and manganese are just a few of Gina's concerns. Her son has autism, something that she believes can be linked to the industrial pollution in her neighborhood and the outside storage of a coal-like fuel product called petroleum coke, or pet coke for short. When Gina was pregnant, she didn't even feel comfortable taking a walk as prescribed by her doctor. Nowadays, she worries about sending her son to the playground.
My neighborhood borders the Indiana border. In Indiana, there's the BP oil refinery. It's one of the largest refineries in the United States. You know, they're refining the oil, and the product of that is pet coke. It produces a lot of dirty energy, so it's not legal to use it to heat homes in the United States, but overseas in China, they use it. And so they needed a place to store it because they're producing so much of it. So they just shipped it, you know, over to my neighborhood because it's a graveyard of industry. In 2014, I started seeing really large black piles of soot all along the bridges near my house. A lot of my neighbors would be having picnics and there would be black soot on their food. There's two little league fields that have been contaminated with lead, arsenic, and manganese. Parents were super concerned because they said their children had been playing on that little league field for the past 30 years. You know, some parents have been coming out of the woodwork telling us that their children have died from cancer and they had played on that field.
It's not at all the kind of childhood we would wish for an American family. Leslie expands on the link between environmental harm and childhood wellness.
You know, you have playgrounds next to refineries. Those kids are being exposed to contamination. It's all over the place. You know, I've seen schools cited next to polyvinyl chloride plants and refineries and lead smelters. West Dallas, they had to close that lead smelter and move everybody away because a lead smelter was put across the street from public housing next door to a middle school. The Cesar Chavez School in Houston. Those kids are like walking. There's no sidewalk. So they're walking on the elevated pipelines or they're walking on the road next to the trucks, you know, and they just do that every day. And just that low level everyday exposure into their developing bodies and brains. These are all future contributing citizens to our country. They should be all of our kids. But the kids, given the chance, can recover and be part of the solution. Our society depends on it. It's not just a nice thing to do.
In our last episode, we introduced you to Aaron Bernstein. He's the interim director of the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at Harvard University. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics there and also a pediatrician. He describes the situation as apocalyptic.
Climate change is Armageddon in slow motion. You have to really be paying attention to see it in the health of people every day. But the reality is if you look, it's completely obvious. In the summer, we see extreme heat, longer periods of heat, and this is not random chance. This is a consequence of greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere. There are people getting sick that wouldn't have gotten sick because they're getting exposed to the heat. Those people include folks who have to work outside, people who are older, women who are pregnant and exposed to extreme temperatures may have worse birth outcomes.
While pollution certainly makes it harder to breathe during a kickball game or soccer practice, heat magnifies the situation. And as you may have noticed, because of climate disruption, it's getting hot. Too hot for some children to play outside, not only because of heat stress, but also other hazards like allergies. In 2012, nearly 10% of American children suffered from hay fever, likely because pollen season has doubled since 1995 on account of rising temperatures. Gastrointestinal illnesses can also be linked to climate disruption. The National Institute of Health estimates that 2 to 19 million cases of such malaise can be attributed to drinking water in the United States. In addition, there were more than 19,000 cases of foodborne illness, the highest incidence of both occurring in children younger than 5 years old. Researchers have found that both types of infections may increase because of rising global temperatures. And of course, there's the ongoing obesity epidemic, too. For children who are overweight, these factors compound to create myriad complications. Here's Aaron Bernstein.
Obesity is not a consequence of climate change, but it now is going to exist in a warming world. And what do we tell children who are obese? Well, you should try and exercise more. You know, obesity, it turns out, is a major risk for asthma. Oh, and it's also a risk, of course, for diabetes. Outside on a hot day, your asthma may get worse, your diabetes may get worse, and so you may not go outside or exercise very much. Hot air is conducive to making ground-level ozone or smog, and that triggers asthma.
Another problem you might not immediately relate to climate disruption is the rise in vector-borne illness or diseases transferred from insects and other animals. Things like malaria and Lyme disease. According to the Centers for Disease Control, Lyme disease affects about 300,000 Americans each year, with boys 5 to 9 years old at the greatest risk. Rising global temperatures are believed to have prompted the emergence of Lyme disease in parts of the country where it barely existed in the past.
The most prevalent vector-borne disease in the United States is Lyme disease, and that's transmitted by a tick. There's some evidence that suggests that climate change is contributing to the spread of the ticks to new territories. All insects are cold-blooded. They move to stay out of the heat. And so it shouldn't come as a great surprise that their habitat would move northward. And it's, you know, one of these games of roulette we play with climate change. You know, it's likely that there are places that are going to be not okay for ticks or mosquitoes to live where they were previously because it's going to be too hot. It's going to be hard to pin down exactly when and where these things might happen because, of course, we people tend to not like these things living near us, and we may do stuff to prevent them. And the great example of that is, you know, malaria, which was widely prevalent in the United States. And because we drained wetlands and sprayed insecticides, we eradicated it. The issue of how climate affects infectious disease is a big one. It just seems particularly unwise to potentially force the spread of mosquitoes or ticks to places that they haven't been before and expose populations that have never seen these diseases to them. It's really disabling to communities when there are outbreaks of new infections.
I think we can all agree a kid's life should be as carefree as possible. So having to deal with physical setbacks like asthma or allergies presents one unwanted obstacle. But there's also a mental health element to consider. From fighting to finish a run on a hot day to constantly feeling congested after walking home from school, these struggles wear down children. It gets at their self-esteem, their self-confidence. They can feel inadequate or inferior to other kids. It might even prompt bullying. That's one side of it. For victims of extreme weather events like wildfires or hurricanes, many of whom lose their homes and communities, the toil takes on a new dimension. A study done by the American Academy of Pediatrics, for instance, found that serious emotional disturbance persisted in 11.5% of children and adolescents 3 years after Hurricane Katrina. Another study found PTSD symptoms in almost half of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders after the hurricane. Because this is important, I want to give you some examples these researchers uncovered when speaking with affected children. One 8-year-old boy who was evacuated from floodwaters where he witnessed dead bodies was found to exhibit consistent disruptive behavior in school when he returned to New Orleans. A 4-year-old girl who had been evacuated before the storm and separated from her parents for several weeks was later expelled from her preschool after attempting to set a doll on fire. A 5-year-old child whose home was destroyed suffered from a sleep disorder and from panic attacks. A 7-year-old girl, rescued from floodwaters and placed in a shelter apart from her family, ended up attending 5 different schools and was diagnosed with involuntary urination, hyperventilation, self-injurious behavior, and PTSD. That's only a brief account of the irrevocable mental harm caused by climate-related natural disasters. Maxine Burkett, one of CPR's member scholars, a professor of law at the University of Hawaii, and a frequent guest of the show, makes another astute observation.
Another pipeline that we don't necessarily connect the dots to, which is the lead to prison pipeline, right? The ways in which these toxic burdens are acutely felt by low-income communities and, again, disproportionately communities of color. And those acute exposures then set you up for the kind of cognitive challenges that make it more difficult for you to succeed. There's a reverberation there in terms of how it affects your family, your household, and then the broader community. If you zoom out on that, you can see that we're poisoning our children and making it that much more difficult for them to have very viable choices in terms of having a productive life.
If children are already demoralized, if they already struggle to find purpose and opportunity, a grim future only aggravates the situation. I'll have Aaron Bernstein illustrate this point with further clarity.
We know from research done on survivors of Katrina, people who've lived around wildfires. For one, what's remarkable is that people who have good mental health at baseline are astoundingly resilient to these stresses. The people who are most at risk are the folks who have existing mental health challenges who are traumatized. The more children are exposed to what we call adverse childhood events, if there aren't appropriate buffers for that child, meaning, you know, adults around the child who really care about the child and are, you know, present for the child when the child's emotionally distressed, if there's not essentially a community of care for that child, that those adverse events wind up causing lifetime health problems. We see higher rates of high-risk adolescent behavior, dangerous sexual practices, drug use, obviously problems with school performance. Into adulthood, higher rates of chronic diseases, heart disease. We know that climate change creates potential adverse childhood events. There's another dimension of mental health that is increasingly talked about that we know much too little about, which are adolescents and some younger children who worry about what the future is going to look like.
Yet another good point. We've now got kids terrified about the future. Deluged with news of the world's impending doom, sometimes there's not enough optimism as to the promises that could lie ahead if we take initiative.
We hear from the scientists that climate change may be at a point where it is, you know, civilization changing in this century. These are 15 to 20-year-olds. And they're saying, well, in this century, well, by 2100, I'm going to be, you know, old, but I'm definitely still going to be alive. Why should I try? If everything is going to go to hell, what's my motivation to do good? What's my motivation to have children? Why would I choose to do that? These sort of paralyzing thoughts about the future. The best analogy we have is you know, the Cold War, where children were asked, you know, do these drills where they had to hide under desks because one day there could be a nuclear bomb that's dropped in their community. At least the governments of the world recognized that this was joint suicide, that the nuclear arms race was a path that destroyed everyone's welfare. And what children in the United States see right now is our government saying, this isn't a problem. If you're not concerned about this, you're not paying attention. And the reason that people are feeling so much hopelessness is not because of fear-mongering, it's because of a lack of action.
Okay, I get it. So far, the discussion has been a little dark, but I think I can offer some much-needed light. I want to introduce you to a pretty cool mother. Her name is Leah Barber. Along with Gina Ramirez, Leah is part of the Moms Clean Air Force and also a member of the West Virginia Climate Alliance. Leah is a wife, a mother of 2 little children, an activist and organizer, and together with her husband, she's built one of the most eco-friendly homesteads I've ever heard of, with the goal of embracing, cultivating, and rebuilding the land. Leah's unique home offers a place for her children to grow up in a healthy environment where they're taught to take care of their planet.
So we designed a passive solar earth-rammed tire home. We picked a south-facing hill and dug into the north side of the hill, so excavated all of that earth out and tried to use a bunch of upcycled materials. So tires were a big part of that, around 300 tires that were packed on site with the earth that was dug out of the hill. The home really self-regulates as far as heat goes. So the house is never really above, you know, 80 degrees and never below 65, something like this. So we still have all of the amenities and modern conveniences as your typical home. We have to be mindful about the battery bank, what time of day we run certain appliances, the materials that we sourced. We tried to be really mindful about using what we had available there on the land. So for example, the wood that we used for framing and finishing work came from trees, some black walnut and white pine that Rob's dad had planted up to 40 years ago. And, you know, instead of drywall, we packed the tires out with cob, which is a mixture of sand, clay, water, and straw. So it definitely got a little bit messy for a while there. The earthen walls are my favorite part of the home, for sure.
Leah and her family grow their own food, and her children take part in the endeavor. It's a way to stay connected to the earth and to show the impact we can all have on our environment.
They really love getting out and being in the gardens, you know, it inspires them to get curious about the world. They're helping us out often, and they're excited when it's time for harvest. I think that the process of growing the food is rewarding for them, and it helps them to really recognize the effect that the human hand can like have on the world. They walk by the planter, they pick greens. It's like a fun, engaging, active thing that they're doing. There has been a disconnect between, you know, some of the ways that we've been moving forward in our society, just with respect to our relationship with land, you know, raising children to have that consciousness around having reverence for the resources that we directly depend on. They enjoy it. And I think, you know, moving forward in their lives will help them make informed and good decisions.
Leah's local sustainable lifestyle relates to another issue that's come into question lately: food security. Drought and heat ravage crop yields, having a significant effect on food pricing and availability. Those impacts also reduce the nutritional value of food. Researchers at the NIH found that increased atmospheric carbon dioxide affects grain quality, lowering the protein content of the edible portions of the wheat, rice, and barley. Since children require 3 or 4 times more food per unit of body weight than adults, declining food production and rising food prices will inevitably lead to malnutrition and stunting. Again, here's Aaron Bernstein.
Where we see the risk for food most acutely are in places that are having trouble with sourcing food, places in the world where people have to import food. A good example of how this plays out in a climate change scenario is has already happened. You know, some years ago, there was a massive heat wave in 2010 in Northern Europe, and it led to wildfires in Russia. That burnt, maybe a quarter of their wheat crop. And as a result, Russia decided to not export wheat. Well, Russia is one of the world's biggest exporters of wheat. That led to huge price increases for all of the countries that were importers of that wheat, and food riots. That political instability that's created by these extreme events, and often in places that aren't even where the extreme event happens, are the fodder for mass human migrations, for the spread of infectious diseases, and for populations of people who experience trauma, which lasts a lifetime. The challenge is that, you know, when we get into policymaking discussions, people want to say, well, what's the return on investment? Mass migrations of people have huge effects on the world population. Adaptation works when you have lots of money. You can build seawalls, buy air conditioners, get the electricity to power those air conditioners. These are not solutions for the world's poor. You know, the idea that all we need to do is you know, build our own personal Fort Knox to keep ourselves healthy is completely wrongheaded.
Unless, of course, you're Leah. Though even she admits that the scope of her homestead may not be a viable option for most families. But never forget, small adjustments can make a difference.
The beginning stages of implementing that kind of lifestyle, you know, weren't very easy. We were co-creating our house, building a family, a young family at the same time. And So really it came through as more of a commitment to the land and more of like a lifestyle dynamic, meaning, you know, we try to tap in where we can and use resources wisely, you know, with the thought in mind of contributing as little as possible to our carbon footprint. As a young family living rurally in Appalachia with not a lot of you know, capital, but what we did have on our side was time. We had more time than we had money. And so that was just, we just made it happen. And I think that when it comes down to, you know, just a more realistic way for families to incorporate those green practices into their lifestyles, it may not mean a complete lifestyle shift similar to what our family chose to do. Maybe it just means, you know, simply becoming aware of issues that affect you and your family and making small changes to have less impact in your daily life.
So, if you can't build a house made of tires, one step towards building a better future may simply be to provide stimulus and inspiration to others, to lead by example and offer a range of solutions. As we've pointed out, many young people feel dismayed, powerless even. Let me quote Jamie Margolin, the 17-year-old founder of the climate activist group Zero Hour. In her testimony before Congress, she said, "Everyone who will walk up to me after this testimony saying I have such a bright future ahead of me will be lying to my face. My generation has been committed to a planet that is collapsing." These discouraging thoughts must be confronted and thoughtfully countered by all of us, and particularly by those of us who are parents. Like Aaron Bernstein argues, it's not the government that's doing this to us.
Don't blame the government. We are the government. Blaming the government, we're blaming ourselves, and we all feel disempowered. It's easy to be cynical. It's easy to say, what potential value do I add to something that seems helpless? And the answer is everything. If we have the bandwidth to get to the point of being dismayed, and you have the resources and education to have gotten to that point, then you're absolutely the person who can make a difference here. I think we need to do a much better job of bringing the issue down to size, of making it personal and making it actionable. Once we get to that point, then we're going to see people in government on board.
Leah Barber adamantly believes that establishing an investment in the environment at a young age will have a long-lasting impact down the road. It's something parents can do as role models and leaders within their families.
Our fervor and tenacity toward clean air and climate justice, I think, comes from a place of like primal instinct. You know, we have this incredibly keen sense for when things are going awry, and that passion just really increases when our children are unnecessarily hurt or vulnerable. So really trying to effect changes that are going to set their future up for success and so that they're able to thrive. And so for me, that is a good way to start talking about, you know, the human impacts on the earth and different ways that it can look, you know, like, for example, that loving stewardship of growing up a plant, or, you know, the other end of the spectrum where we're really talking about, you know, pollution and waste.
On another note, why aren't we more concerned about what the climate crisis is doing to our kids? Why aren't we voting for more measures that will change policies in their favor?
That's because children don't vote. I tell you a story about a researcher who was involved in one of the seminal studies on air pollution in the United States, which showed in sort of the first time that air pollution was killing people. That published study went out and the authors thought, boy, this is going to be a big deal because, you know, people probably thought that air pollution was bad for your health, but no one had really quantified the magnitude of the problem in the United States. More or less, no one paid attention. And no one paid attention because everyone thought, well, you know, people die of something, you know, they die of heart, you know, heart attack, they die of stroke, whatever. And the authors went back and said, well, this is a problem because these are preventable deaths. These are people who would not have died had they not breathed air pollution. And they did a secondary analysis of middle-aged men getting heart attacks. And all of a sudden, all these policymakers were horrified that air pollution might give them a heart attack at 55. We have this ability to talk a lot about children but not invest in them in a way that is even proportionate to what a narrow view of their economic value, and starting with the economic value of children, i.e. these people are going to be grow up to be productive members of society, is probably the most base approach to understanding the value of children to our welfare. But even on that front, we're radically underinvesting. And we do that at our peril. I mean, you know, the number one reason for being unfit for military service today is obesity. The obesity pandemic and epidemic in the United States did not land upon the planet from Mars. We created it, and it's not in our genes. It was created through how we deal with the environment, how we deal with our diets. We haven't invested, is pretty clear. The reason we don't is because children's voices are not making decisions.
For Maxine Burkett, giving people a little smack of reality might make the difference, particularly when it comes to something like climate disruption, a problem that's massive, yet often invisible. Raise the stakes. Define what we have to lose. Empower people, especially young people, to take a stand. And when they do, have their backs.
You don't need to go into the weeds about the specifics with climate, but you do want to encourage them to love nature, to know how to connect with their community, and to, you know, cultivate the kind of emotional resilience that they're going to need. I am the descendant of people who were enslaved, and the kind of strength that that required, and frankly, in the absence of even clear evidence of hope, suggests to me that we are capable of surviving conditions that are so difficult, and still, you know, the possibility of a miracle, which I think my ancestors would think of, you know, if they were to see my children, would think that this was a miracle. So I actually pull from that sense of strength and ability to survive, and ability to have the clarity of understanding of what it means to be able to live a good life when the external conditions suggest otherwise. So for me, a big part of this discussion about how you approach this is not just about hope, it's about courage.
As they say, plant seeds, tend to the roots, watch the gardens grow. And on that note, I'll add, give your kids a watering can too. That's it for today. Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information on this episode and the stories behind it, or to find out how you can be involved in combating climate change, please visit our website, www.progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CPRblog, all one word, and on Instagram, Progressive Reform, all one word. And of course, subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends. I'd like to thank our guests today, Dr. Aaron Bernstein, Maxine Burkett, Leslie Fields, Gina Ramirez, and Leah Barber. You can learn more about them on our website, too. Thanks also to our wonderful producer, Courtney Garcia, and our fantastic assistant producer, Brian Gum. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.